I see a lot of people reaching for the hand sanitizer and the antibacterial soaps in an effort to keep bacteria at bay, but it turns out microbes may not get the proper credit they deserve. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Learning about microbial communities and what they do for our world, specifically in the area of bioenergy. Microbes are always hard at work inside of us, helping us to digest food. It bolsters our immune system, even maintains our mental health. And we have a couple of researchers with us today to talk about microbes and their role, perhaps, in bioenergy. Tim Donahue back with us once again, professor of bacteriology. He directs the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, interim director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. His labs work on understanding the ins and outs of microbes, trying to unlock the secrets of microbes to benefit all of us. And he's run that Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center since it was funded nearly 11 years ago. Tim, great to have you back.
Great to be back, Larry.
I think it was 11 years ago when you were first on the show to talk about
this. I think so. We were each looking a little more healthy then.
Younger, for sure. Oh, man. Dan Nogueira is a distinguished professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison. He's taught at the UW for 21 years now. One part of his research lab works in biofuel production, getting microbial communities to work for us to help advance bioenergy. Dan, welcome to the show. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And let's get your questions about microbes and bioenergy. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. What are you curious about and how microorganisms work? What do you want to know about how maybe antibiotics impact microbial communities? Or maybe you're just curious about the research these guys are doing in bioenergy production. Again, join us at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. You know what? Let's go back. You know, microbes are tiny. They're too small. We can't see them with a naked eye. When you look at microscopic organisms under the microscope, Tim, what do you see?
Depends on where you look, and it depends on how you look. For the most part, you tend to see larger microbes. Some microbes come in different sizes and flavors, and we'll talk about that hopefully. Uh-huh. There are larger ones that have organelles like a nucleus and whatnot, and mm-hmm. those include yeast, and we know yeast very yeah. well if we make bread or fermented beverages in the state.
Yeah.
There are smaller ones, bacteria that don't have nuclei. We tend to think of those in the food area. They make cheeses and things like that, or yogurts. And then there are even smaller ones, viruses, and that you probably wouldn't see with the microscope. You would see the big ones. You might see the medium ones, depending on how strong of a microscope you have access yeah. to. You wouldn't see the viruses. And, you know, now there are people on campus studying microbes that broke the rules that I was taught when I was an undergraduate, because they're so small they pass through filters that you would normally have used to identify microbes in freshwater or marine samples. So the microbial world is still exploding.
And we've got apparently trillions of them living in and on our body. How do they all get there? We weren't born with them, were we? Or were
no,
we?
Actually, we are. You acquire microbes as you are born. They change. They develop just as you do as a newborn, based on your diet and based on other genetic factors. People don't like to hear this, but the human body is basically a big incubator for microbes. As you said in your intro, there's a lot more microbes in your body than there are human cells. There's a lot more genes that power those microbes in the human body than there are genes that decide whether you're going to need glasses or have red hair or brown hair or anything else as you grow up?
Well, some of them make us sick, and some of them do a lot of good and are really important for our health. How do we distinguish the good and the bad ones? Dan, you want to take that?
So, as an engineer, I don't look at microbes in the same way that Tim does.
Yeah.
But I look at the function of what they might be doing. So, and I don't know much about the medical side of things, but yeah. I look at microbes and I look at what functions they have to be useful. For example, we use a lot of microbes in communities to treat the waste that comes out of the city or industries, and so.
Oh, sure.
Those are the type of benefits that we look at.
Yeah.
In microbes.
So when I talk to people on campus or around the U.S., I tend to put microbes in different bins. There are microbes that Dan and I think about on a daily basis that I would refer to as green microbes, because they do renewable, sustainable things for us in the production of chemicals or fuels. There are those that make us sick. My colleagues in medical school departments don't like it when I refer to them as the dark side microbes, but that's what they do, right? And then there's a bunch of microbes that do other useful things for society, like making cheese and making bread and making fermented beverages industrial sites not that far from us here in Madison, right?
And we're looking at them now as a source for potential energy, or a potential energy source for us.
That's right. We have used microbes as sources of energy for a long time, using a process called anaerobic digestion. It's in the local wastewater treatment plants. It's in agricultural lands. And we take these microbes and we can produce methane, for example, which can be burned, and you get energy out of that. But what we're trying to do is what I like to call the next generation of energy from microbes, and it's not just converting these materials to things that are known, but trick the microbes to do other things that might end up in biofuels or other chemicals.
So train them or trick them?
It depends whether you're an engineer or not. If you're an engineer, you like to think you know everything and you can train them.
We do some training of them if we modify the environment, and we can keep them for long periods of time just doing one thing or try to make them eat something. They adapt. They allow themselves to have changes. But we also train them, and we go inside of them, and we change some functions, change a protein or inactivate some gene, and we get the products that we want that way.
Give me an example of your work or your research. What you're looking at.
So, there we go with lignin.
Lignin, sure. It's fine. Let's go. Let's look at lignin.
So lignin is a natural component of plant materials. It's one of the biggest polymers on plants. There is the cellulose, hemicellulose, and there is the lignin. Lignin is a polymer made of aromatic molecules. It's the largest source of natural aromatics that are on, except fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. But we can do very little with that because it's a difficult to separate polymer. So you use some chemistry and you break them down into something that the microbes then can eat, like individual monomers that they can eat. So naturally, this is something that has occurred in nature for many, many years. So they will take the aromatics and grow and produce energy, but they completely degrade that. That's not what we want.
No.
We want to maintain the aromatic ring or maintain a large molecule. So we remove certain enzymes from the organism. We make them not make that, so we stop the degradation of the aromatics and accumulate carboxylic acids, for example, that could be used for other industrial processes.
So you don't take a cornstalk and throw it in with a bunch of microbes and see what happens.
There are people who are or have done that. Decades ago when I was first hired here. People out at the Forest Products Lab were looking for biopulping to see what microbes could do to soften woody biomass. And they found, by doing that, they got a large number of fungi, larger microbes, to go back to my original question, that were really good at throwing enzymes out of the cell and degrading the lignin polymer into smaller pieces. Now what Dan is talking about is looking at bacteria that are probably in that ecosystem, taking those little pieces and converting them into high-value chemicals. So you can actually, if you will, have your cake and eat it here. We now have ways that we can process lignin, either in the plant or with microbes, to make pulping less energy costly and more economically viable. But we also have ways of taking that lignin and instead of burning it for heat, like we were thinking about 30 years ago, converting that into commodity chemicals that you currently think about getting out of fossil fuels.
So, and then those commodity chemicals are used in what? A broad range of things?
They're used to make plastics. They're used to make fiberboard. They're used to make nylon, depending on what the chemical is that you make. So, to put it in perspective, Larry, out of a barrel of oil, we tend to think about getting fuel, and we do.
Yeah.
A oil refinery makes only a fraction of their money on selling gasoline or jet fuel. They make the large amount of their money on making petrochemicals. So we're now actually looking at taking corn stover and making both fuels and replacements for petrochemicals out of it.
So that's a big, that could be a big, big market.
Yep, it could be. And so the aromatics that Dan has talked about, if you were in the chemical industry, they would refer to them as BTX, and I don't want to get chemical, but that's benzene, toluene, and xylene, three of the large aromatic industries that are then either used as is or are dressed up or repolymerized into other things like plastics and nylon and things like that.
Wow.
So it is a big market.
Wow. Interesting. Well, we're going to talk some more about that. Tim Donahue, our guest today, and Dan Nogueira, both involved with the University of Wisconsin, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, where Dan's is a distinguished professor of civil and environmental engineering. And Tim directs the Wisconsin Energy Institute and also the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Join in with your questions. And what are you curious about with microscopic organisms and what they do in our world and with energy? Hope to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. Talking today with Tim Donahue and Dan Nogueira from the Wisconsin Energy Institute, University of Wisconsin Energy Institute. Great to have them along. We're talking about microbes today and how microbial communities power our lives in so many ways. Again, questions for them. What are you curious about when it comes to microbes? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You think they're going to be useful in making energy for us or byproducts of energy that can be useful in plastics and other areas? 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. There's got to be a lot of challenges associated with this kind of work, I would think, Dan. What are some of the major challenges that you see?
I think as much as we have learned in the years of science, microbiology, and understanding genetics of these organisms, there's a lot of things that we still don't know. And we can get the DNA of the microbes and sequence the DNA and learn everything that is there and annotate it, and the majority of the things that are still in there come up as we don't know the function.
Yeah.
Right. So we're trying to modify organisms to do other things for us, but we encounter many situations in which we make the predicted change and things don't go the way they are.
Yeah.
But that also generates additional discovery, because we follow that lead and it gets us to identifying what the function of other enzymes are in there that we didn't know about. So it's part of the discovery process.
And I would think sometimes even those side types of discoveries can actually lead to some new products or new ideas as well, Tim.
That's the vision. I don't want to say to hope, because when you write a grant or ask for money from the federal government, you have a hypothesis and hopefully they'll fund you. If you say you have a hope, you usually don't get funded. But that's the vision of what we're doing. And we already have a lot of invention discoveries and licenses out there and industrial interest in what we're doing. So we're trying to create a future where, in this case, excess material, industry doesn't like to call it waste, but residues can be used to power any local economy in the state of Wisconsin and the Midwest.
Let's take a call. Kim in Browntown, it's your turn. Thanks for calling, Kim. What's on your mind?
Hi. I wondered if you could use forest waste, like from logging operations. They leave a lot of slash, and then that, of course, ignites in wildfires. And also, when they log, they tend to take out the biggest, best trees, and then you get these dog hair thickets, very small diameter trees, and could those be thinned and turned into some sort of biofuel? And if it could, is there a leftover product that then can be put back on the land to add soil organic matter back to the land?
So the answers to all of those could, Kim, those are excellent questions, are yes, and that's part of our vision. There are people on campus in Great Lakes Bioenergy who are actually working on woody biomass. The example that Dan gave before the break about lignin is one where we are actually studying trying to evaluate and showing success in using lignin from woody biomass. In this case, it happens to be poplar. It's not a forestry tree that's harvested up in the northern part of the state, but we are able to take lignin from woody biomass and convert it into high value chemicals. After we would take part of that poplar organic material, separate it, and convert the other part into a fuel. So we're trying to make value from as much of the ton of biomass as we can. Going back to the other part of your question, for the state, there is a lot of forestry material in the state and a lot of forestry activity that creates residue. Waste, if you will, wood chips, or you mentioned other parts. All of that we would like to think is a potential feedstock for us to convert into fuels and chemicals. Some of the waste would be a little more difficult than others. For example, the bark of a tree is brown. That means it has a much higher lignin content than the actual stump or middle of the tree, so it would probably need to be processed in a different way. But those are all things that we're looking into.
Mm-hmm. Does that help out, Kim?
Yeah, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, I was thinking, like, there must be mounds and mounds of, like, sawdust, for example, but I would... But that's from... A lot of that comes from the center of the tree, so that may be more difficult to process.
Actually, the center is white. If you look at two pieces of paper... If you look at a piece of paper that you're getting white on, it's white. If you look at a piece of cardboard or the pad on the back of the mound of paper that's brown, that's because that brown paper hasn't been delignified. The white paper is that lignin taken out of it. That's why it's white. Again, if you look at the bark of a tree, it tends to be browner and denser. It's got a higher lignin content than the actual stump or the middle of the tree.
I'm wondering, I'm thinking about climate change.
Okay.
Does that have an impact on microbes?
It's a circular statement. It does have an impact on microbes, and microbes have an impact on climate change. So as the temperature of the oceans or the lakes change, or as the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the air or filters into the ocean changes, it changes the chemistry of that environment, and that changes the microbial inhabitants, right? If you eat a lot of yogurt, your microbiome is going to be different than if you don't eat a lot of yogurt. Conversely, the microbes in these environments take a lot of CO2 out of the atmosphere, and so they can have the potential beneficial effect of mitigating the CO2 that is put into the atmosphere from human activity.
Interesting. Join in with your questions or comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You mentioned yogurt, and that somehow reminded me of what moose eat. And I know that there are some researchers who are sampling the guts of moose to understand how they break down woody things like twigs. Dan, is there any insight we can get from moose guts as to how we approach biochemicals and our biofuels and bioproducts?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of, again, unidentified activities in there. It's an anaerobic environment, so there's no air in there. That's when we look at transformation of natural materials to produce chemicals, we look at aerobic environments where oxygen is the main thing that the microbes respire, and anaerobic environments. And the benefits of an anaerobic environment is that you don't have to provide the oxygen. You don't have to pump a lot of oxygen into your process, so that could be more cost effective. And so microbes have evolved different ways to deal with the same type of chemicals. So when we look at aromatics, for example, from lignin, there are transformation pathways that depend on oxygen. But there are also transformation pathways that are strictly anaerobic. So studying some of those transformations from the moose god might eventually
have some impact here.
Have some impact, yes.
Yeah, and so, for example, you know, Dan talked about this lignin work that we're doing. These are not well-studied microbes that we're now learning how to work with and seeing how they work. This was an organism that was originally isolated not on a wood pile, but from an aromatic contaminated site in the Savannah River Basin in Georgia. It was a polyaromatic waste site. And in its genome is a large set of genes that encode activities that do novel things that no one's ever seen before. And we're able to go in there and tinker with those and understand how they work.
So you take a quart of that home and work on it, or what do you do?
Well, we took the isolated organism that had been deposited in a strain collection and had been sequenced. And when we looked for organisms to work on, we saw that this organism had a large number of things that were predicted to be useful, and we decided to work on. We decided to evaluate it with five or six different candidate microbes, and we ran it by some standard tests, and this one turned out to be a winner. And now we're finding out, not only were we right that it has a bunch of things that we predicted would be useful, but it has a large number of capabilities, chemistries, that no one had ever seen before. And that to me as a as a microbiologist, that's really exciting because it allows us to get at a whole new frontier.
So what? Can you give me an example of one of those unusual things that you found?
Well, boy, we're going to need to get a little chemistry. But when plants make lignin, mm-hmm. Dan said they polymerize these aromatic units into these big polymers.
Yeah.
And they do it by chemistry. And when they do that, they make right-handed chemicals and left-handed chemicals.
Okay.
And up until 2 years ago, all of the enzymes that had been discovered from these bacteria that can eat lignin either only ate left-handed or only ate right-handed molecules. So in this organism that we isolated from the Savannah River, not isolated, someone else isolated, but we decided to interrogate, we now see enzymes that can eat both right and left-handed molecules for the first time. So that really simplifies the types of chemistry you would need to think about doing in industry, because you might be able to get away with fewer catalysts to do the jobs than if you only had enzymes that ate left-handed or right-handed molecules.
And so the upshot of that is products eventually,
lower cost, simpler ways to process them, things like that. Yeah.
Can you describe what this process is of when you put, where do you put, let's say the lignin, for example. So you've got these tree parts.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with them?
We take trees, we grind it down. You use the analogy of sawdust.
Yeah.
You don't put the whole tree trunk in there. You process it to a point where you can handle it. We then dissolve that material in some kind of a solvent. And we've developed a proprietary solvent on campus in the lab of Jim Domesic. I won't get into the details. But from that, it dissolves. And then you can separate the major fractions that Dan talked about.
Mm-hmm.
The lignin from the polysaccharides. Depending on what part of the field you're in, we then take the polysaccharides and we convert it into fuels. We're now taking the lignin part and we're converting it into chemicals. The idea is we want to make value from every gram of that tree that we started with. When we began this work 10 years ago, it was all about separating the lignin from the polysaccharide, but all we were really capable to do technically was make fuels from the polysaccharide. Now we can think about making product from the lignin as well as making products from the leftover material after you make fuels from the polysaccharide. So in that, if we're successful in all of this, we will be making valuable products from as much of the biomass as possible and allowing what we would call, in an engineering term, a next-generation biorefinery to have a smorgasbord or a suite of products that it makes. And the economics of that is very different than the economics of making one fuel like ethanol only from one fraction of the plant starch. So it looks much more like a petrochemical refinery.
Yeah, so going back to that barrel of oil you were talking about earlier, that oil barrel is not just, the oil itself is, I'm sure, a nice portion of the money that comes in, but a bigger portion perhaps comes from the other.
The fuel is about half of the profits. The chemicals are about half of the profits, but it's only about 20% of the volume.
Wow. So that
is... Because believe it or not, in the U.S., fuel is a high-volume, low-cost per volume commodity. I was just in Ireland 3 weeks ago, and I spent a week, and they're paying about $1.5 euros per liter, which equates to about $9 a gallon for a gallon of gasoline.
$9 a gallon.
Yeah.
I don't think that would go over well.
I'm not promoting it. I'm just saying fuel is a high volume, low cost per unit commodity. Chemicals are smaller volume but high cost per unit.
I know there have been quite a few studies have shown that taking antibiotics, people's microbiomes can alter it for months. I think you were getting that at a little bit earlier. But if you take antibiotics, that can have a big impact. This is on the microbes that are involved in your body, and that can create problems.
Well, I think we know that antibiotic therapy has a major impact on the microbes in your body, right? Whether mm-hmm. whether you were some of the first people to get antibiotics in World War II because you were injured using antibiotics that were developed on the Madison campus, or whether you have a child who has a strep throat, you hope when the doctor writes you a prescription and gives you an antibiotic, it controls that microbe that is causing that problem.
Okay.
What we don't know is how many other microbes are affected by that antibiotic and whether that has positive or negative impacts on your child's health in the week or the month, in the week that they're taking the drug or the month after they take the drug.
Yeah.
That, because those were questions we were really never equipped
to answer
very well up until very recently. Mm. And those questions, along with questions like food, along with questions like, is the genetic makeup of Larry such that you would respond to an antibiotic differently than John when given the same antibiotic? Those are all questions we don't have answers to.
Well, Kay in Sauk Prairie has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Kay. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have two questions. One is, can the microbes be used to break down plastics? And the other one is, what are aromatics? I think of aromatics as scents.
I should have made that clear with a question earlier, but go ahead.
So go ahead, Dan. Why don't you start?
So very recently, a year ago or 2 years ago, there was the discovery of some microbes that were able to eat plastic. And that's a very exciting discovery. I don't know exactly which type of plastic, but some microbes out there have been described as having acquired the ability to break down some type of plastics.
Dan is correct. That is a great question, and there are recent reports of microbes being able to eat plastics. So we think of plastics as things that society has made or man has made. I hate to be inappropriate, mm-hmm. but they're man-made chemicals, and you would think they're not able to be degraded naturally. But I'll say something else that often gets others of my colleagues on campus upset, this time in the chemistry department. Microbes have been doing chemistry for a heck of a lot longer than people have. So if there's a chemistry out there, microbes probably have the ability to do it. That's why we like mining microbial genomes for new types of chemistries. They may be able to eat some plastics that are man-made, but whether or not they will be able to eat all of the plastics that we have been able to figure out how to make since World War II in the plastics industry, time will tell, but I think we should keep looking. You also asked, what are aromatics? And you, I think, had a really good definition of aromatics, and those are things that have an aroma, fragrance. So you're right. We're not talking about degrading perfume, however. We're talking about degrading other types of aromatics. Another place where you'll run into aromatics a lot in your daily life are in things like mouthwash, because they are actually antimicrobial.
So those are actually closer to the types of aromatics that Dan and I are talking about in lignin. Things that are at low level, and because they are antimicrobial or antibacterial in microbes, in mouthwash, are actually many of the types of chemicals that we're talking about degrading in this lignin project. And that may seem counterintuitive to you, but let me explain what is going on. How is it that microbes, that you can eat things that you think about being in mouthwash, when in fact mouthwash is there to cut the microbial population in your mouth, because that's where you get bad breath, right? Mm-hmm. It turns out these are very specialized microbes that have the ability to eat aromatics that would normally kill other microbes. And that's why we're really interested in studying them. Not all microbes are created equal or equipped with the same set of activities. If you look in certain environments that are rich in certain chemicals, you will find microbes that probably have figured out either how to subsist, survive in that environment, or actually grow on the food that they see every day, or else they would have died millions of years ago, right?
Very interesting. Well, how promising is this research? Well, you know, the work that you're doing, Dan.
I think it's very promising in the sense of being able to convert renewable resources into some type of fuel and chemicals. We need to figure out that challenge and overcome the limitations that we currently have of most of our society being fueled on fossil fuels. So it's a very important part of what we need to be doing.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense to me. You agree with that, Tim?
I agree. I mean, to be cynical, it's one of the things that gets me out of bed every day. but to be a little more pragmatic about it, I think this is a renaissance period for society's ability to understand what microbes are doing for us and to us in the planet on our daily life, not only our body, but also to figure out what we can learn from them and how we can use that to benefit society, whether it's in Lake Mendota, whether it's in the air that we breathe, whether it's in the microbes that are in the soil that affect crop production, or in the feed that affect dairy production, or whether it's making fuels from renewable waste. I think there's a huge potential headspace there for us to tap into.
And on that note, on that positive note, it's we are out of time. I want to thank you guys very much for taking time to be with us today. Been a great pleasure. Tim Donahue, professor of bacteriology, directs the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and is interim director of the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Dan Noguera, distinguished professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison, has been a teacher there for 21 years. And he looks, one part of his research at least, looks at biofuel production and getting microbial communities to work for us to help advance bioenergy. Great to have them with us, and we'll be back in January 28th next time around. We'll have some folks from the Energy Institute back to talk with us again about other aspects of the work going on there. But it's the last Monday of the month, and on the last Monday of the month, the weather guys always stop by, and they're probably banging on the window trying to get in right now. So we'll be talking with them in just a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.